Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to this meeting. It's a NORCOG meeting. For the people who don't know what that is, it's the North Shore Council of Governments, which is a group that functions within the town of West Monroe, town of Constantia, village of Cleveland, and the village of Central Square. And we just try to deal with issues that are common amongst all of those communities on the North Shore. I know a lot of you are here to hear about the wetlands law, which is going to be a presentation, but we do have to have a regular business meeting, and we're going to try to get through that as quickly as possible. And you see that on the agenda. And I won't say much more, but the people up here are voting members of NORCOG. There's usually two from each one of those four municipalities that I mentioned. We can introduce them. There's Frank Tomino on the right, Dale Mahar, Vern Sundet, and Randy House, and myself, Richard Colsani. Missing is the village of Cleveland. So we'll start our business meeting. We'll get through this stuff as quick as possible. And there is some interesting updates in the agenda, and then we'll get to the wetland stuff.
Paul is a circuit rider who basically coordinates between the commission, or between NORCOG and sub-government.
Thank you, Rip. Yeah, a couple things to handle under financial tonight. I've put up front there with you a rough copy of the current year budget so we could start planning for the budget for 2025, which would normally be adopted at the first business meeting in the new year. Another thing that we need to talk about, oh, and you see on the budget there that I have the expenses between both North Shore and Salmon River, since some items are shared items between North Shore and Salmon Rivers. Some are individual to each individual COG. The other thing that we need to talk about, probably because we have Heidi coming on board very shortly, is setting things forward for her reimbursement, because things will change somewhat when she is going to be the lead circuit rider and eventually the prime circuit rider in North Shore and Salmon Rivers. While I've been a circuit rider, I've had a separate cell phone with a separate telephone number for COG business. Heidi is just as comfortable operating off of her own phone and her own cell phone number. Some of the other COGs do that. North Shore and Salmon Rivers does things in the way they've been doing it, but in NOCOG and in Cooperative Tug Hill, I believe, Katie Malinowski, our Tug Hill Executive Director, prepared a comparison chart between the COGs to see how different COGs handle different things for comparison purposes. And in several of the other COGs, they provide just a stipend flat out every month that covers both their both the cell phone expenses and some portion of their high-speed internet expenses, since those are pretty vital to our being able to operate. So one thing that we need to talk about is how we want to handle that, and we really need to we'd want to do that probably with November, since Heidi will be starting in November. We did a little chatting with Vern about setting forth a flat rate policy for Heidi at the rate that we're currently paying me in terms of reimbursement for cell phone, and probably doing that quarterly to reduce the number of checks that Vern would have to write. And he was fine with that, but we wanted to run it by the whole group to see how they felt about that and if that sounded okay. If we did that, it would be no more expense to the COG than we are currently doing. And of course, you'd probably want to review that from time to time to see how it met up with the expenses that Heidi was incurring. So I guess I'd like to throw that out to the group and see how do people feel about that, and does that seem like a good way to proceed? And we do that starting in November, because for a while, both Heidi and I will be on the payroll and circuit riders for North Shore and Salmon Rivers. So I'll be dropping off after the first quarter of next year. And at that point, it would be just Heidi being reimbursed. Again, some of the different COGs do things in different ways. Some of them do reimburse the associates for cell phones, some don't. So, but to keep things simple, I really wanted to get things settled for Heidi for now. So does that sound okay?
Yeah. Can you vote on that?
You probably should.
You have the coverage with your Verizon, right?
I have Verizon so far, yeah. I don't know if I go for North Shore and Salmon Rivers.
And have you determined how much of the stipend for the cell phone is?
I think in our chats we were discussing $30 a month. I would note that in some of the other COGs, some of their COGs go as high as $100 a month to the lead circuit rider in the area.
And that would be
cell phone and some portion of their internet, yeah.
Salmon River would do the same?
Well, they would, again, this expense would be split between North Shore and Salmon Rivers because right now the cell phone expense is split between North Shore and Salmon Rivers. So 30 would be split, so you'd be paying 4/10 of that. Or 4/10 of 100 if you decided to go that way, or some figure in between. I mean, you could decide on 50. Well, that might be a separate thing. Quarterly on the cell phone bills and monthly on the mileage. First, when she becomes a prime circuit rider, she won't be billing you for time as she does as an associate, but she still will be submitting for mileage. But yeah, I would think monthly on mileage and then quarterly on the cell phone and internet combined reimbursement.
Well, then if the motion is for $30 to type in a month, I make motion.
Between the two groups?
To make motion, we accept that. All in favor?
Any more discussion? If not, all in favor? I think you got that, Heidi. Now, one other thing that's Heidi related and related to the transition to Heidi being the circuit rider for North Shore and Salmon Rivers is some time ago, you authorized the purchase of a new cell phone for me and actually a laptop for me because the computer that I'm using for most of my work is one that's a large computer that is kind of cumbersome to carry around with you. And it's been convenient for me to carry a computer around with me, not just for routine work, but for in support of Zoom sessions. So you authorize that purchase for me. It's something that I haven't implemented yet, either on the cell phone purchase or the laptop purchase. Since I'm close enough now to the date that I will not be the circuit rider for North Shore and Salmon Rivers, that is money that could be made available, applied towards the laptop purchase. And I threw the question out to Heidi to start looking into, we still want to buy a laptop, but she would be able to buy a smaller, lighter laptop that she could carry around with her. Right now, the laptop that you've probably seen her with at meetings is her personal one. So if anything happens to it, oh, well, that's up to her. Just like if I carry one of my computers around with me, oh, well, if I drop it or break it, it's up to me. But there really should be a laptop for her to be able to carry around two meetings that isn't a big, heavy unit. And we did authorize that. So I want to let you know that we're moving now towards buying one for Heidi rather than buying one for me. Heidi is looking into that and she'll be working with Bern on that to be able to buy it tax exempt. And that's more of a FYI type of item because it was already authorized for the COG to buy it. Again, that's an expense that's shared with Salmon Rivers. So mainly just wanted to bring that up so you'd know what it was that we were up to in that respect. And I think that's all we have for financial. We'll talk about financials, I'm sure, more at our organizational meeting, if that's our next meeting, which would be in January. And I'll provide you with updates along with Vern in between. And I think that's all we have for financial for tonight.
Qualitative Municipal Agreement.
I can touch on the intermunicipal agreement. We last, as individual communities, signed on to the North Shore Intermunicipal Agreement in 2020. And under the way the state law works on that, those need to be renewed once every 5 years. So It was several months into 2020, as I recall, that we actually all signed that. So we don't need to have that done on the dot by January 1st, but we should get that done in the first part of the year. And there probably are some issues that we need to take a look at. I've emailed everybody a copy of the current intermunicipal agreement with the agenda that I emailed out for this meeting. So you might want to take a look at that. And between now and then, I'll be taking a look with Heidi at the intermunicipal agreements for the other councils of governments. And we'll probably come up with some, I can't see anything huge coming out of that, but there probably will be some fine tuning type of changes that we want to make. And when we do that, we'll circulate that, and that'll go to each of the town and village boards for their adoption. And then we'll be good for another 5 years. So that's all there is on that. Like I said, the intermunicipal agreement is both on the NORCOG website, www.norcog.org. And it was in that email that I sent out. And if anybody needs a copy, that's probably the best bet for getting those.
Paul, take, so you're done with the intermission?
I think we're done with the IMA, yes.
Take a minute and explain to the audience the 5-second deal on the connection between the Tug Hill Commission and NORCOG.
Okay.
I forgot that.
Yeah. For those of you that aren't familiar, my name is Paul Baxter. I'm the circuit rider for North Shore and Salmon Rivers. And Heidi is my successor after I retire in the first quarter of next year. I am an employee of the New York State Tug Hill Commission. Katie Malinowski, who's the executive director, is here as well as Matt, our planning director. Basically, what they do is they provide me to the North Shore area, which is made up of Constantia, Cleveland, West Monroe, and Central Square, and the Salmon Rivers Council of Governments, which is made up of Albion, Amboy, Orwell, Parish Town, Parish Village, and our newest member, the Village of Pulaski. I work for both those cooperating groups, and between those two cooperating groups, we share expenses. Tug Hill picks up my salary, but there are other expenses like mileage and, as I mentioned just a couple minutes ago, the primary desktop computer that I use for my day-to-day work is provided to me by Tug Hill as well as a printer, but the cogs pick up replacement toner, for example, when I need to do that. So basically some of the consumable type things, and the cog covers the cost of my mileage and my cell phone, which they will be doing again for Heidi when she's starting in November. The COG, which is the cooperating group on the North Shore, also pays for other expenses like the associate, which is kind of like my assistant and helping me cover meetings. Does that cover what you're hoping for me to cover?
Anybody have any questions on the organization? I don't think they do.
Yeah. And the other part of how that works is each of the municipalities that have signed on to the intermunicipal agreement pay annual dues. And then the fiscal agent, which is the town of West Monroe and Vern, writes out the checks after they've been audited by either the chair or the group in whole. Or sometimes I review some of them before they get as far as the chair.
Go ahead.
They are.
They've been scared.
They're the two chairs right there. They were invited, but they did not attend tonight.
No.
I was, or either Heidi or I were at their last village board meeting, so we're in monthly touch with them. Yes. And so they were aware of tonight's meeting.
They don't think it's tomorrow meeting, do they?
I hope not.
Because that was on Thursday.
It did say Thursday on the agenda, but it said okay. Wednesday the 30th in multiple other places, and I would like to thank Dean Gass for being the first one to point that out to me, and I issued a correction on the agenda, but the email itself as well as the message header all said Wednesday the 30th, so, and I've been saying Wednesday the 30th for the last month, so hopefully nobody will show up here tomorrow night. Yeah.
Okay, next one is the Oswego County Trails to Rails update.
Well, good evening, everyone. For those that you I have not met yet, I'm Tim Stahl, the Director of Community Development, Tourism, and Planning for Oswego County. You might notice me from one of these boxes. I'm typically inside of one of them, but I wanted to come out tonight, make sure I had an opportunity to meet you and answer any questions that you have had. I heard there's, you know, some concerns and some questions, and so I just wanted to stop out and really just be here to see what you, you know, what is important and what maybe we can do to help. So the first thing I want to start out with is talk a little bit about the county's recreational trail. I know that I received a letter talking about the concern about the condition of the trail and potentially what the county could do to help improve that. So we did work with the county's highway supervisor, Sean Walker, and I believe, although I have not physically laid eyes on it, you can let me know, but my understanding is that he's been out there for the last few weeks, or his guys have been. They've been working on really repairing that section of the trail. He expects this year to get, and again, you know, it's miles and miles and miles across the entire county. They typically will go out there once the paving stops and before the plowing starts. That's kind of the window they have. And each year they try and do a certain section of the trail. So this year's plan was to go from county line. He plans to be able to get all the way to 49 by the end of, before this, you know, obviously weather dependent, before the weather stops him from doing that. He did say they've been able to do some light maintenance across the trail the entire, I know they've mowed it and they've done some, but the plan would be for this year to get to that 49. And then obviously in future years to kind of work around that. So that's the, as far as the maintenance goes, there's been some conversation about, my understanding is investing some time, some money into that trail as more of a recreational, you know, either for snowmobiles or really more, what could this look like if we invested some funds there? And so one of the conversations I'd hope to bring up today, and I don't see Mr. Turner, Dave Turner, he's our strategic initiative director for the county. He oversees the infrastructure conversation we've been having. And so I know a bit ancillary, I don't really have the full understanding. Austin Wheelock is here. I know he's got some additional information, so I may call on him on that. But one of the things that we are looking at, and I think, you know, in light of Micron and everything that's going on, we are looking at how can the county better invest in infrastructure like wastewater, potentially drinking water, broadband, things like that. What can the county do and how can we help out the towns and villages who really need it? One of the conversations that we're actively looking into would be, what would it look like to put in a trunk line all the way across that recreational trail? You could connect certain important strategic locations of the county without, you know, really disrupting too much life, right? We've got a trail that runs the entire stretch. We have access to it. We could potentially, if we had funding and we worked with the right partners, you know, we could down the road put some sort of trunk line wastewater system right through the whole backside of the county. So that's one of the conversations we're actively having. It's the most realistic one outside of ripping up streets all across the town, you know, the towns and villages, and the cost to do that obviously would be very expensive. So the reason why that's important to this conversation is the last thing we want to do is invest a bunch of money to pretty up the top of it, only to go through, rip the entire trail up and put in wastewater lines. And so one of the conversations that we're actively working on is, if we were to put this wastewater line across the county, part of those grants is typically what it looks like when you're done, right? You can beautify it. We can invest some funds at that point. And so that's the conversation I just wanted to bring now, is that it's ongoing. We fully expect that if and when we put that trunk line through there, it will not be just rubble piled on top of it. It will be some sort of a strategic plan that we work with the communities to best utilize that, get your highest and best use for that section of trail. So as that conversation goes on, this is not a tomorrow thing, right? Obviously, this is, you know, any of that infrastructure investment is potentially a 5, 6, 7, 8 year project. So we want to work. My understanding is the county is looking to help out over the short term, you know, find ways to help improve it. But obviously investing a ton of money at this point may not make sense if we are going to be ripping that up. So the thought would be, keep you folks involved, you know, in the conversation. So if and when we get to that point, you know, if this is feasible and we can do it, then, you know, you folks are going to be involved in that process, or whoever wants to be, of what should it look like when we're done, and how do we make sure that this is, you know, the most efficient use of that space and taxpayers' funds. So that's kind of a quick overview of it. We're early on. I want to be frank. We're early on in this process. This isn't happening tomorrow. But any sort of investment like this, you know, takes a lot of planning. and take some time to see it through. So I'll kind of leave it at that for now. I wish I had more information on specifically where we stand as far as the wastewater plans. I don't know, Austin, if you want to give a little bit of what you understand.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to say from the perspective of Sco County, it's sort of an unprecedented intermunicipal project. It's a project that stretches the city of Fulton, which actually has the wastewater treatment capacity through Balney, Scruple, Hastings, then jumping over to West Monroe, potentially Constantia, and maybe even all the way to Cleveland. So, I mean, it's something that we haven't seen to that level before, really stretching from one end of the county to the other. I do know that the conversation kind of started on the western end of 81. You know, that was the original kind of concept of looking at from Hastings back to Fulton. But I think that there is a need as well on the eastern side. And obviously you guys have been working towards a wastewater project that this may be able to be a good fit for that. You know, it has a lot of advantages. I mean, you wouldn't have to take control waste actually into Oneida Lake. You could take it all the way to the Oswego River and, you know, get it out that way. Obviously a lot goes into that. A lot of, you know, we have the DEC on here as well, and they're obviously, you know, with that kind of plan, they would absolutely be involved in that. But I think it has momentum. I think that because of the potential of the Micron project, the potential for growth and everything else that's going on, the county is now looking and saying, how can we work with our communities that have a need but don't necessarily have the resources to make it? So, you know, not a lot more details on it, but just the why we're looking at doing it and what we hope to see come from it. But you know, Tim is right. It's years in the planning and then years and, you know, years further in the implementation.
So go ahead.
Back to the maintenance part of it. Is there an actual maintenance plan that the county tries to hone with the trail? Just general maintenance, like, because I know years ago they fixed it up with grindings and they were taking pretty good care of it, and it seems like it dropped off, and so there was like a big lull or a gap, and that's why it got so deteriorated. So
that's a great question.
Do they actually budget for it? Is there a plan, or they got lost someplace or put on the back burner?
What I would say is I don't know that I've ever seen a formal plan. I think it has been a case of competing priorities in the past where when there's availability, you get it done. When there's not, if there's staffing issues or other things that are stretching it, it's more difficult. One thing I will say is that, and I want to be gentle with this, but some of the usage more recently has caused it to be deteriorating quicker. And that's something that is, you know, part of the conversation is, you know, typical use the way it was even 20 years ago, 15 years ago is a little bit different than some of the use of it today. You know, whether that's allowed or unallowed, the reality is there's traffic going on there that is really doing some damage. And the amount of my understanding, and again, this is a little outside my world of knowledge, so I apologize, but I did talk to the supervisor Walker this afternoon to talk a little more to understand specifics. And he had said it's something that is important to them, but you can only do so much with the staff you have and, you know, the county, the rules, the size of this county that we have. You know, they do a great job, but their focus is, you know, drawn across the entire county. So I do think it's something that he said that is important to them. And it is something that they have, you know, they've done this stretch 2 years ago, 4 years ago, they did this stretch. You know, next year their plan is to kind of move farther to the west. But what that looks like, I think it's open to conversation too. And that's what I want to encourage you to is, you know, keep me in the loop. Sean, I know is doing the best he can with what he has, but the more we can have these conversations, the more I think when he does have windows, we can prioritize what's important to you.
If it is a staffing thing, would they consider reimbursing the towns to take care of their own sections?
I don't know if I can answer that question. I think it's worth a conversation. Again, I don't want to say no to anything. We should have those conversations. Sure.
It's a general maintenance on the trail or same thing, put a budget forward, have them approve it. Yeah.
I think it's something we definitely talk about. I don't know enough about that world to speak to it, but yeah. I mean, I'm not here to say that we won't listen to anything or have conversations. And again, we understand the importance of that trail. I mean, it really is a great asset that we have out here, and you know, to have that maybe not being maintained the way we would love to see it, maybe there's a way forward that we can figure that out between us. So
is there consideration given to restricting the type of traffic that's on that?
There is, and I believe there are restrictions. And the bigger issue a lot of times is I don't want to say enforcement. I just want to think the capacity. I mean, if you think about the response to a call, right? I mean, you're not going to have people patrolling it. We're not going to have sheriff deputies riding up and down there all day, every day. That's not reasonable. And so the response to a call is based, you know, on the size of our county, where they are, where our nearest person is and what they're dealing with and how quickly can you get there. And if someone's on an ATV or something else out there, by the time they may get there, you know, and so I think it is a difficult situation. And I will tell you, I've had great conversations with the current sheriff. Sheriff Hilton is very interested in finding a path forward that works for everybody, understanding the limitations we have in this county. But it is, you know, the ATV traffic is not going away. The reality is we're seeing more and more and more of it, more than ever. And so part of the conversation might not be, you know, punishment, things like that. Maybe it's finding a way to make it work in a way that works for everyone. And what does that look like? And how do we invest in that? Because I mean, the reality is, I don't think we can say don't drive. I just don't think it's going to happen. I think people are going to keep driving. So how do we work with that?
I would have to find it hard to believe that it's the, because even way before the ATVs, pretty familiar with it. It's always needed maintenance, or it's always been the same kind of maintenance, mm-hmm. just the base or whatever. So I don't, you really can't blame it on a certain. Mm-hmm. Well, when's the last time you heard about it before?
I don't. Right here. Right here. That's
one. Yeah, Dave.
It's always been like that. It's always been looking to use and so that was before this.
I think your best bet is you try to combine, mm-hmm. you know, pedestrians and ATV and use it.
Right, and part of the issue of that though too is some of the sections of that the width is challenging, right? And how do we work that out?
Maybe get a little more width.
Yep.
Maybe. You know, take care of it at that time.
Yep. Reestablish the boundaries.
Yeah,
and I think that's all part of the conversation. Where the plan is to have is how do we really make this thing useful for everyone? You know, how do we make it not a liability at times, but really the asset that it should be? So
it is a very good asset, but it could even be better.
Yes, yeah. I think I mean I don't know anybody who would disagree with that. I think it's just kind of how do we get to that point.
Dave Turner is on.
Well, Dave Turner is on. Okay, so Dave Turner, it looks like David's iPad. Is here. So Dave, I don't know if you, I just kind of like gave a quick update with what I knew, but if you want to give a little summary to these folks about the infrastructure plans for this area, or at least the discussions.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you for your patience. I just got home from work. This is why I couldn't join you in person, that I had other commitments tonight that I knew were going to keep me late. So my apologies. So I'm not sure what Tim or Austin might have shared with you, but we have had several discussions, one with some of the leadership in Constantia, West Monroe area about this proposed trunk line sewer that would, at least the study that's going on now is being hosted by the town of Hastings. They have Barton and Judas taking a look at the feasibility. Potential costs. We've met with the city of Fulton. They're very much excited about this. And I'm very happy to tell you that just yesterday I had a call with the DEC. The people at the water staff and clean water staff, and they asked if we would make a presentation to the regional director because they're very excited about this project. They think it can be an example for others to use about intermunicipal cooperation and the advantages of not everybody trying to have their own wastewater treatment plant, but working together to share assets and do it in a way that makes sense for the region and economically for all the partners. So we're getting ready to present this to not only the new regional director, but some of their Albany clean water and water staff. They're very interested in knowing about it and who our partners are, and potentially our partners are everybody along that corridor, including you folks. At some point, it would make sense to tie this end together with the other. And I think there's already some infrastructure in place that will make that easier than you might expect. So I'm excited about it. The people who own the existing assets are excited about it. Now the regulatory folks are excited about it. So it's just a matter of trying to find a way to make it work and put the money together to create a project that everybody will benefit from.
Does anybody have any questions for Dave or Tim?
The nice thing about this also is that while I know that there's been discussions about the trail and multi-use and enhancement and signage. So when you do a project like this, there's restoration work that goes along with it. And I think there's likely a way that we can work into the restoration budget some of the enhancements for the trail that we otherwise would have to find separate funding for.
Thank you, Dave.
Thanks, Dave. Austin. Yes, Tim. Thanks.
Okay.
The next topic, update on changes in standards for fire service.
Sure, I'll take that one. We're changing it up today. Katie Malinowski, Tug Hill Commission. At the last NORCOG meeting, there was a lot of firemen in the room, and we had a hearty discussion about the potential new OSHA changes in the fire brigade standard and what that could mean to volunteer fire departments. There was a lot of concern that it could decimate some of the membership of those because they wouldn't meet the standards and would have to step away from fire service. As a result of that meeting, there was a letter drafted. I know several councils of governments, perhaps some municipalities, and some volunteer fire people sent letters to elected representatives, to OSHA, to kind of make their concerns known. I went out today to find out what the latest is, and on OSHA's website, they put out a statement on September 17th, so that's since the last NORCOG meeting, and it was regarding the emergency response rulemaking, this new potential fire brigade standard, and how this might impact volunteer emergency responders. It sounds like they've heard a lot of you talking to them, and they're concerned about how that could affect. So they're saying, and I can leave this in the back, but right from their statement, it says OSHA is committed to taking steps in any final standard consistent with the rulemaking record to assess and minimize detrimental effects on volunteer fire departments. If supported by the record, and that means all the comments and everything, this may include excluding voluntary emergency response organizations entirely based on these feasibility concerns. So that's their way of saying they might exempt volunteer organizations from having to meet the OSHA new standards. So, I mean, we heard last month or last meeting that you all are trying your best and you want to keep your people safe and do things as, you know, as good as you can. But some of these things are just very, very onerous in terms of the costs and the requirements. So that's the update that I have on the fire service section. And while I'm up here, do you mind if I jump around, Rip, so I don't have to like come up and down and okay. So really quickly, the Route 49 traffic study. So that was something that the town of West Monroe requested the Syracuse Metropolitan Transportation Council a while back to consider funding a Route 49 traffic analysis. They accepted that. They said they would be it would be starting in April, I think was the earliest it would be starting this past April 2024. They're just really getting organized for that. And I know they have gotten their local reps straightened out. I think Vern is the rep from West Monroe. And I think they really wanted Central Square at the table. So between Randy and Ken Sherman, they're going to cover the Central Square part of things. And they plan on having a first meeting for that very soon. We also have a staff person in Watertown that deals with traffic related issues. So he's also going to sit on that committee. So I think that's a really good step forward. Obviously, the 49 bridge closure has really kind of highlighted the issues with 49. We all knew there was a lot of traffic, but now everyone's feeling it because of the reroute. So that's the update on the Route 49 study status. And Heidi's got the update on the closure and the temporary bridge construction.
Hello, everyone. For those of you that don't know me, my name is Heidi Tompkins. I will be taking over for Paul here shortly, as it's been spoken about this evening. So update for New York State DOT, we got an update from Region 3. Paving is scheduled actually for tomorrow, and they are expecting installation and inspection of that to be done on November 11th and November 12th. From there, they'll open that up to traffic as long as everything goes well with the inspection. So that's really good news, especially for a lot of people that are sitting in this room. What's next? I don't have the agenda. Is it me?
So I have commission updates, which we can tag team that too. So as everyone's heard, so it's kind of old news, but November 7th is Heidi's official start date on the Tug Hill Commission payroll. She has been the associate circuit rider, the assistant for over a year now, I think, actually. But we're lucky enough to get her full-time in the payroll starting November 7th. So you're going to see Heidi a lot more at your meetings. And Paul will still be here. He will be continuing to help with the transition, which is great. We're really happy we can have this overlap. Paul's also got some time he needs to take off before he retires, so that'll be nice. And he's got, I don't know, 40 plus years of files to sort through. It's amazing how much paper you can accumulate over the course of a career. So Paul will be focused on that kind of thing. The other thing I just want to mention really quick is that a plug for the Tug Hill Local Government Conference. Many of you may have been there in the past. It's going to be March 31st and April 1st of 2025 at Turning Stone. So mark your calendars. April 1st is the full day of training. And then March 31st is just the afternoon. And that afternoon, the afternoon focus session, one's going to be on vacant buildings and housing issues. And we'll have we're going to actually split the room and have another track about budgeting and accounting with Laird Petrie. So we're really excited about our agenda, and there'll be more to come very soon on the details.
The only thing that I ask from board members or anyone, I guess, in Tug Hill Commission is from now on, just keep Paul and I in all your correspondence. It'll be both of us that'll be responding and just trying to help out with that transition. So
It'll save me doing all those forwards to Heidi that I've been doing.
Does anyone have any questions for me? I'm looking forward to working with you guys along with Sam and Rivers. Thank you.
And last but not least, I'm Matt Johnson. I'm the planning director at the commission.
Can you get a little closer to the mic?
Is that better?
Can you pick it up?
I can fly. A lot of demand, Paul. Just a real brief overview of some things we have. Basically, the main thing, the planning wing of the commission has going on in the Norcog region, and that is helping the town of Constantia with work on developing a zoning law, which would be the town of Constantia's first ever zoning law. It's a difficult, grinded out process, but hopefully we're getting to about the halfway point, something like that. So kudos to the town for taking that on. I think that's really important. You may have heard me report at other meetings that our planning staff capacity has been really stretched to the limit the last couple years, but we're pretty sure that that's going to improve. So stay tuned and we can hopefully get out to more communities. One thing we can do for you that I want to mention is we can do training for planning boards and zoning boards. And I don't think we've done any of those in the Norcog region in a while. So if your planning board or your ZBA is interested in getting some one-on-one training, please call the commission or email us and we'll try to get you on the schedule. We're also available to talk to you about what we can offer and some more details on that. And I want to do just a really quick update on what we know about the Micron project as of right now. You've probably read about that in the paper that the groundbreaking has been delayed. I think the latest groundbreaking is now expected to be November of 2025, so a year from now. The draft environmental impact study is in progress, and that's expected to be complete by the end of 24 with a public comment period available or coming, opening up in the new year sometime, January or February. You've probably heard that there have been extensive issues with wetlands and some endangered bats that might be sort of slowing down the process, along with some other economic issues. But with that, anything related to Micron, we always are telling communities you really want to try to do some planning in advance of that. And I'm sure Tim will back me up on that, and Dave will back me up on that if he's still on there. But this is the time, if you're at all concerned about, you know, the impacts of Micron on your town or your village, this is the time to really start thinking about that. We are hearing a lot from our eastern Oswego County towns and villages. A lot of them are looking for planning help. We're hearing from Albion and Pulaski and Williamstown, in addition to Constantia. They're all very interested in getting to work on some planning and zoning work. So we think that's great. And we encourage everyone here, all the towns and villages, to at least review your plans and your zoning if you haven't already. I think that's it. Thanks.
And in between speakers, I'll mention I brought out another pot of coffee if anybody else wants a refill.
We have a speaker for the nine element plan.
Well, let Austin do the economic development, okay. The housing. So.
Yeah, I know I've come to several of these in a row, and I think at our last one we mentioned that the Oswego County IDA in partnership with the Oswego County Legislature was starting a housing study. It's actually called a housing market assessment and development strategy. So one, we're looking at the existing housing stock all across Oswego County and then looking at opportunities for development for housing, everything from new single family housing to multifamily, market rate and affordable housing. So We had actually our first steering committee meeting last week as the group that is pushing this forward with our consultants, which actually we selected MRB Group, which had done the economic resiliency study out here on the North Shore. So they already have a pretty good understanding of the area out here. We're actually, as part of this, looking at some of the studies that they had done in the past, we didn't just want to do a one-size-fit-all study for Oswego County. So we actually looked at breaking Oswego County down into mini regions, actually. So one of the mini regions they're looking at is the North Shore area, saying that a lot of these communities have a lot in common. So a strategy that's put forward localized to the North Shore can be used here, which will be obviously different than the strategy that's pushed for the city of Oswego, city of Fulton, northern Oswego County, or what we're calling the Southtown communities that are just across the border of the river from where Micron and that development in Northern Onondaga County is going to happen. So we've also put together separate focus groups for local elected officials that may have already reached out to you. I know that they've already started meetings with some of our local elected officials across Oswego County. We put together a focus group for real estate professionals for them to get an understanding from home builders, from other housing developers, from land bank, from other entities that have their pulse on different areas of housing and can give them a good understanding of how that works in Oswego County and what they see as the opportunities and some of the barriers. We'll be having our next steering committee meeting in early December with our plan of wrapping up the study in late February, early March. And then there will also be a marketing piece with information on strategic sites and key info that'll be developed about a month or two after that. So, but the study itself will be wrapped up by about February, March. So, what I'm thinking is that we could probably come and make a presentation on sort of the, you know, that study, you know, in sometime in the spring. So I would say probably March, but maybe it might be a little bit after, depending on when that comes out. So I think that it's a great thing that we're working on. To my knowledge, we've never really done anything like this. We're kind of behind some other counties and regions around the state that have done this in the last couple of years. It's obviously in need. The Syracuse and Central New York region has been identified as the second hottest housing market in the U.S. right now in terms of the percentage of cost increase just over the last few years. So obviously there's an issue with supply versus demand. So we're trying to look at how we can help to bring some of the housing, invest in the highest use, and bring the kind of housing that we want to have in Oswego County. So that's really an update on that. Like I said, it's something that the Industrial Development Agency and the county legislature really partnered on, and because we see it as a huge need. And I look at it this way: if we want more business to come, we need to have more workers here, and to have more workers here, we need to have the kind of housing that they need. So it's all related together. And if one of those things isn't working, then it's going to impact the others. So anyway, any questions on that? Okay, thank you.
Okay, so I think I'm the last thing before we get to our featured speaker. So I should have said this when I was up here earlier, but the Oneida Lake 9E update, we reached out to the Central New York Regional Planning and Development Board, who is taking the lead on the Oneida Lake water. It's a watershed plan. They call it 9E. It's short for nine element. It's just a certain way of approaching watershed planning. It's been going on for a couple of years now. And the update from Central New York was that they're continuing to do the computer modeling, looking at different scenarios that were developed by the advisory committee earlier this year. Those different computer modeling scenarios include things like temperature and precipitation increases, increased levels of phosphorus, which could come from additional septic systems in the watershed if that were to happen in the future. And what happens if things like cover crops or septic system improvements or improvements on farms happen? What does that do to the water quality? So they're just doing all these modeling exercises on the computer at this point. If it continues to progress as they hope, they plan on holding a public meeting on the results of the modeling in the spring of 2025. So that's my update. I'm not really involved in it, but that's what Central New York said. Lots of things going to be being presented and talked about in the spring of 2025. So that's all I got. I don't really even want to take any questions because I won't be able to answer them. So, and you're going to introduce Krista? Okay. So Krista is with us tonight. Krista, do you want to just double check and make sure you can share your screen? You should be able to.
Yes. Yeah, let's see.
Oh, we can hear you great in the room. That's
yay.
So Krista is with the Department of Environmental Conservation in Albany office. She has been the point person for public participation for the new proposed DEC freshwater wetland regulations. And I really can't do a better job of introducing her than that. So I'm just going to turn it over to Krista. And if you'd like to say anything else about yourself before you dive in, please do. Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you. Can you guys see that first slide?
Yes, we can.
Okay, fabulous. Thank you for that introduction. And thank you so much for accommodating me and allowing me to do this on Zoom. I really wanted to get out there in person is what I, what works best. I love to meet new faces, but, we have this tool, so why not use it when I can't make that happen? Before I get into this, I'm just gonna, because this is long, and I'm glad I got you guys this presentation before, so you can digest and also have some time. But I also want to say there will be time for some questions. It's about 45 minutes long. Because we are still in step one, and step one is getting these regulations adopted. Step two is the nitty gritty of the regulations and exactly how you'll be regulating them. So any case by case basis, any like site specific things for future determinations after January 21st, I cannot answer those for you. The best I got for you is to look at the statute, and there's a QR code and website at the end of this. So look at the express terms and try to figure out if it's close or not. By the end of December, we will have those SOPs out. We will have more of, the nitty gritty of the direction of how exactly this is happening. So let me start And just, we're talking about these wetlands regulations today, and it's all about the mapping and the classification. So first of all, we're going to be talking about these statutory changes, the current regulations and the challenges, the draft regulations implementing changes, the advance notice of proposed rulemaking, the feedback we got from that, and how we revised the express terms because of that, permitting through the transition period, examples of GIS application of the criteria, general programmatic process changes, and public comment period and the hearings. So our freshwater wetlands regulations are housed in three different parts. The part 663 is where the permit requirements are. Part 664 is where the mapping and the classification are. Part 665 is where local government implementation and minimum land use is, but we are just changed, legislation just changed part 664, so the mapping and the classification. These are all the sections of where those changes are found. That's why I'm very glad you guys have this presentation so I can just buzz through these big ones. Currently in part 664, we have mapped regulated wetlands and anything that is greater than 12.4 acres. There is an unusual local importance that makes it regulated, and that's if there was something like a bog turtle in that wetland. There's only 13 of these unusual local importance wetlands throughout the state. There is a 100-foot adjacent area around the wetland that we regulate as well. This gives the wetland a little bit more space to be able to protect those benefits, those wetland benefits. You might have heard called a buffer area. Internally, DEC uses adjacent area, but consultants and others use buffer area. Those are interchangeable. And we classify wetlands 1 through 4, 1 being the most restrictive in the permitting process and 4 being the least restrictive. So like I said, we classify those wetlands 1 through 4, and we classify them on the ability to perform wetland functions and provide wetland benefits, the special ecological importance that wetland might have, like an inland porphen, special features, habitats for endangered or threatened species, hydrological and pollution control features. So currently in part 664, there's 40 criteria, and in a class 1 wetland, there is 7 criteria. So currently, we have these maps, these regulatory maps, and these are based on a field visit of each site, taking in consideration the wetland type, the benefits of the wetland, the distribution and location. And they were drawn up just like this cartographer is doing in this picture. So there's an overlay of the aerial photo, and they circle around where those wetlands are found. So we're going to enlarge this portion because I'm going to show you how these maps are inaccurate. And then this is the original air photo. You do the overlay and you can see the shaded in portions is the wetlands using old technology, using new technology is the outlined green portion. So there's a lot of wetlands being missed on the landscape because we're using old technology. So let me give you a little bit more context on why there's a need for change. So in 1975, Article 24 of the Freshwater Wetlands Act was introduced. By 1984, the first county had finalized its map. So that's how long it took for the first county to get their maps all identified and drawn up on the maps. By 1992, we realized, okay, these maps are inefficient and we need to do some amendments to them. So then by 1995, we realized how inefficient the process was to do these map amendments because there was so much that goes into it, as resources, including money. You have to send out a certified letter of mail to all the people in the parcel that are involved. You have to put notification in the newspaper. They estimated it was about, maybe I have it on there, but it was estimated about to do all the map amendments in New York State, it would cost about, I think it was $7 million. Not worth it. So then in 2011 and 2022, the effort with the main goal was to remove the maps as being regulatory. So currently there's about 1.2 million acres on the maps, 1.2 million acres of wetlands on the maps. It's estimated we're missing about a million additional unmapped wetland acres that meet our jurisdictional criteria, but because they're not on those regulatory maps, we can't protect them. So these are the implications of the inaccuracy of the regulatory maps. There's confusion for the regulated community and DEC, ongoing jurisdictional questions, difficulty for project planning, development, and design, delays in project implementation, and the statutory resource protection goals are not being met. So basically, our maps stink. So that's why the significant statutory changes to the Freshwater Wetlands Act came to be. So there's three key changes. One, the maps are no longer going to be regulatory. They are going to be informational maps. These informational maps, the modeling is being done by Cornell Institute for Resource Information Sciences. Previously mapped and informational maps will be available online in December. That is going to be housed either in the environmental resource mapper or the DEC info locator. So the second is the acreage threshold. So we're maintaining the current 12.4 acre threshold from 2025 to 2027. In 2028, the threshold decreases to 7.4 acres. And then the third key change is wetlands of unusual importance. So unusual importance shall mean a freshwater wetland, regardless of size, that will possess one or more of the following characteristics as determined by the department pursuant to the regulations. So these are the 11 criteria. Located within a watershed with significant flooding, located within or adjacent to an urban area, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. It contains a rare plant species. It contains habitat for essential behavior of endangered, threatened, special concern, or species of greatest conservation need. It is classified by the department as a Class 1 wetland. It was previously classified and mapped by the department as a wetland of unusual local importance. And like I said, there was 13 of those in the state. It is a vernal pool known to be productive for amphibian breeding. It is located with a FEMA-designated floodway. It was previously mapped by the department on or before December 31st, 2024. It is a wetland of local or regional significance. It is of significant importance in protecting the state's water quality. So, summary of the key changes in order the what's going to determine these jurisdictional determinations is the regulatory maps no longer being regulatory, they're informational maps. The acreage threshold dropping, staying 12.4, but dropping to 7.4 in 2028. And this unusual wetlands criteria. So if we go back to this unusual wetlands criteria, if you look at 6 and 9, these are basically the same thing. So it's pretty much 10 criteria instead of 11. It's kind of like that Jimi Hendrix song, If 6 Were 9. So looking at these criteria, or these five unusual importance criteria, these are so specific in the statute, there is no room for us to have to do any interpretation. Where the work was and why we did two rounds of public comment is we had to really put our thinking caps on and define what these ones were. And we really tried hard to strike a balance environmentally and economically. So located within a watershed of significant flooding, habitat for essential behavior, of endangered, threatened, special concern, species of greatest conservation need. It is classified by the department as a class one wetland. It is a vernal pool known to be productive for amphibian breeding. It is a wetland of local or regional importance or significance. It is significant importance in protecting the state's water quality. So looking at the existing part 664, like I said, it's class, we are keeping the classification system 1 through 4. There's 40 criteria. The assignments are based on site visits of each wetland to identify and assess these three things. But basically, it's field-based classification scheme. When looking at the proposed Part 664 drafting, the remote jurisdictional determinations and classification system needs efficiency. So determinations must be timely, repeatable, objective, consistent process with the same outcome among all staff, and appropriate wetland classification assignments made based on objective ID of classification criteria. So this is a data reliant, data driven JD and classification assignment. So there is, so this main difference with the regulatory maps is currently, if you had a question about jurisdictional determination, you would go to your region and that region would answer, they would look at the maps. And if there was any sort of question, they might come out and look at the site. And now instead of going to the region, it's all going to be done remotely. So you're going to call center, or there's going to be a form on the website that you will fill out to get a jurisdictional determination. And the same kind of thing, if there is a process, if there's a disagreement, because once you put that form in for that jurisdictional determination, and anybody can put in a jurisdictional determination for a parcel or a project. And once that is in, then you will receive a letter of notice, and it either will say a negative determination or a positive determination. When you get your positive determination, we will also tell you what classification that wetland is. So on January 3rd of this year, we put in the advance notice of rulemaking. So the goals of this rulemaking was to engage with the public in an open, transparent manner to inform the stakeholders of the New York State Freshwater Wetland Program and the changes on the horizon. We wanted to solicit and receive stakeholder feedback and input while developing the new proposed rules. And we wanted to provide an efficient mechanism with time to act on that feedback early enough to to change the regulations. Because again, that statute says we have until January 1st of next year. So there is a lot of reoccurring themes, a lot of clarifying questions on definitions, implementation, and data. Concerned we will be overwhelmed with the workload, permitting for projects already in the development pipeline, vernal pools, how will that work? Because in New York, we've never regulated vernal pools before. Questions regarding the jurisdictional determination process. So these are the changes we made regarding those, the feedback. So first, the permitting protocols for projects already in the pipeline. And this is just a picture of, there was three new biologists hired in Forest Central office. And these are the ones that will be doing the remote jurisdictional determinations. So projects meeting the following criteria prior to January 1st, 2025 will be allowed to continue without any change in Article 24 jurisdiction for the following specified terms. So projects with mapped state regulated wetlands, if these conditions are met before 2025, if issued DEC freshwater wetlands permit or DEC notice of complete freshwater wetlands permit application, doesn't matter the scope of the project, whether it's major or minor, there is new regulations won't apply until the permit that they currently have expires. Projects without mapped state regulated wetlands. So the conditions must be met that are must be met before 2025 is if there's a final environmental impact statement or a negative declaration for a type one action or the site plan approval by the municipality. So the scope of the project is dependent here. So if it's a major project, they have 3.5 years, so until July 2028. If it's a minor project, they have about 2 years, so that's till January 2027. So next is amend the JD process. It came up that what happens if DEC misses that 90-day jurisdictional deadline? We have 90 days after there's a request for a JD comes in. So if the department fails to provide a definite answer in writing within 90 days, the requester shall make notice of that failure by means of certified mail. If the department then fails to provide a definite answer within 10 business days of the receipt of such a notice, freshwater wetland jurisdiction shall be deemed waived for a period of 5 years from the date of the waiver. So regulated vernal pools, this was one of the big ones that we had to do a lot of thinking about, and there's a lot of questions around. It states the department shall create and maintain a list of geographic coordinates for vernal pools known to the department and that meet the criteria in subparagraphs 1 through 6 of paragraph G in this section. The department shall publish updates to the productive vernal pool list in the environmental notice bulletin. Apologies. So, in order to know what's productive in a vernal pool, it has to be a list of known productive vernal pools. So, the Natural Heritage Program had already created a survey of New York State of their vernal pools and the productivity. So that is what we looked at. They looked at species groups, geographic area, that's why the state is broken up into 5 different areas. And we have to list this on our website. So the changes that were made to the vernal pools because of the advance notice is the process for landowners to notify DEC of productive vernal pools. So basically right now, when 2025 starts, the only vernal pools that will be regulated are the vernal pools that are already in that survey from the Heritage Program. And it's mostly state vernal pools. Very few private ones. This is a program that is going to be voluntary for people to submit their information saying, hey, I think I have a productive vernal pool over here. Will you please regulate it? We did some technical adjustments, and that's in the next slide. And we extended the adjacent area. So the technical adjustments, this is how productivity is determined by the egg masses of the species. And when we put in that advance notice, there was a lot of good data sent back to us that, hey, these numbers are way too high for these species in this region. So then we dropped and we did more research. They gave us the data, and it's actually instead of 55 plus egg masses for a spotted salamander in the Hudson Mohawk area, it's going to be 35. And instead of 30 plus egg masses for the wood frog, it's going to be 10. And then why extend the adjacent area for vernal pools? Because that was a big concern. That 100 foot adjacent area just was not enough. The statute directs us to protect vernal pools for amphibians. Upland habitat is vital for amphibian populations to persist, and all studies conclude that protecting a 100-foot zone is not enough for amphibians to persist. So the question is then, how large of an area is enough? There was a lot of peer-reviewed information that came to us that stated why we needed to extend that adjacent area, a lot of science behind it. And then looking at all of that data, we took the average and the mean of the average, and that's where we came up with, okay, instead of 100-foot adjacent area, it's going to be 800-foot adjacent area, which makes people concerned. So I will show you. And so, A, remember that vernal pools, it's a voluntary program, and it is difficult to get on the list. So you must have wetland vegetation. It must be surveyed, must be productive. So that stringent egg mass chart that I showed, it must be documented. It must be submitted to DEC. And then you must get on the list in order, must be posted on the website in order for that to then be regulated. So say we have a vernal pool that's a little blue dot in the center. There's a lot of site-specific factors for permitting your vernal pools. There's must have, we're looking at the existing conditions, the lot arrangement, proposed activities, practical, whatever, you know that word, options, impacts on habitat and amphibian use. So let's say there's a farm field here. And then we already have some development going on. Now that dotted line is the limit of disturbance. So if you're looking at that vernal pool, right, the green area is more of where the amphibians would most likely want to be. When it's a farm field, yes, they'll go in it a little bit, but it's not their preferred area. And then when there's development, they're not going to go all the way to the development. There's a limit of disturbance, right? So say there's a house that somebody wants to put in, and they're looking, there's a road right there, so they can't go much further out of that 800-foot buffer area. It's blocking them from doing that. So, and they want their limit of disturbance to be that yellow bar. Well, instead of making that their limit of disturbance that yellow bar, that big yard, well, how about we just shrink it down a little bit? Then we're not too close to that vernal pool. And then even further, well, what if we just move the house a little over to the side, so then it's not so dead center into the 800-foot buffer zone? So there's ways that their permitting can still happen. The rules that we go by is avoid, minimize. So we want to first try to avoid any kind of disturbance to the wetland. If you can't avoid, then we're going to minimize. So this is an example of us minimizing. If there's no way for you to minimize, then that's when we get to mitigation. So another thing that's in the regulations that's changing is the extending the adjacent areas. And this is to special wetlands like the vernal pool. So that's 800. And then to 300 feet for nutrient poor wetlands. So example of a nutrient poor wetland is the Brack Spruce Tamarack Bog. It is these special nutrient poor wetlands are all known in New York State. There's 20 of them. And they're on the Natural Heritage Database and the Environmental Resource Mapper. So then when we look at located within a watershed with significant flooding, so how did we determine that? Well, we looked at hydrologic unit codes, or HUCs. So the United States Geological Survey created the HUCs, a hierarchical land area classification system based on surface hydrologic features. So the USGS uses this nationwide system to delineate watersheds. A HUC is a sequence of numbers or letters that identifies a hydrological unit or feature. So these HUCs are unique to each hydrological unit in the state, and it consists of 2 to 12 digits. So it's kind of counterintuitive because the smaller the number, the larger the area. But we looked specifically at HUC 12. So we're looking at the smallest area, and this picture is depicting all the HUCs in New York State. So now, that's step one. We look at all the HUCs, HUC 12s, watersheds, but they have to have three the following criteria. They have to have impervious surface greater than 2%. It has to have a water storage area of less than 5%. And it has to be within 4 kilometers or 2.48 miles of an urban area. This was our way of looking at runoff, water holding capacity, and human risk. So when you look at these things individually, this is factor one, all the HUCs that have impervious surface greater than 2%. This is HUC two, water storage less than 5%. And then factor three, within a 4 kilometers of an urban area. So all of them separately look like a lot, and then it boils down to this. So then things like located within or adjacent to an urban area, that is so explicit. There was no room, wiggle. There's nothing we had to define, but these are the New York urban areas throughout, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. And then looking at the habitat for essential behavior of species of greatest conservation need. So species of greatest conservation need is defined as it contains a habitat for essential behavior in or of a species of greatest conservation need listed in the New York State Wildlife Action Plan, with habitat loss having been identified by the department as moderate to very high threat to New York populations. So we looked at habitat loss because this is more about the habitat than the species itself. And then if you look at all the species of greatest conservation need, there's 300 plus of those. But when you look at the actual habitat, the water, where the wetlands are, that would be that specialized wetland housing these animals, there's only 20 species that are wetland dependent throughout New York State. Again, it's data reliant, data driven. And then the last thing that we changed or looked at in the statute was the appeal of jurisdictional determinations. So if there is a appeal, the positive jurisdictional determinations, the first step to appeal that is an initial consultation on that is a field meeting on the site to delineate and look to see, well, okay, maybe this is where it is or whatnot. So then after that initial delineation, then you have to complete a JDF appeal application within 120 days of that initial consultation. So an acceptable basis of appeal would be an application missing technical information, incorrect application of regulatory criteria, or incorrect application of guidance. And the department has 60 days to respond to this. So our timeline going forward, we did the July 10th notice of proposed rulemaking in the state register. The public hearings were in September. That's when the comment period closed. October, November, right now we're processing the 400 plus comments and then hoping to get regulations to become adopted in early December, and then December informational wetlands maps posted online along with those standard operating procedures, all posted on the website. And then January 1st, statutory amendments take effect. There is the QR code that links to the Freshwater Wetlands Program. There's fact sheets on there. There's this presentation. A little things might be different on it that I gave in August virtually with some questions that were sent in that I answer at the end. I'll leave it up for a little bit longer. Actually, I'll go back to it. So, supporting documents, Q&A sheet. So, I always love to end with a Chuck Norris quote, because who doesn't love Chuck Norris? I've always found that anything worth achieving will always have obstacles in the way, and you've got to have that drive and determination to overcome those obstacles en route to whatever it is that you want to accomplish. It's nice because this is such an overwhelming amount of information and large change that we are doing to our regulation of wetlands. But the bigger picture is we need to really protect these ecosystems. They are very important, not only to the natural world, but to the human world as well. And especially in these times of climate change, like this is the weirdest fall ever. I cannot believe it's going to be 82 degrees tomorrow on Halloween. But anyway, we're going to get past that. There is my information. Thank you so much for letting me talk to you. And without making you guys stay too past, oh, see, I spoke quick enough that I gave you guys enough time to ask questions. But yeah, I'll leave that up and I'll open the floor to questions. And I'm not looking at the comments. So if there's questions on the comments, I don't know how you guys want to facilitate this. If you want to look at comments, I can stop sharing and then I can look at comments, or if there's questions in the audience.
Yeah, can you explain the 12.4 and the 7.4, the acreage?
Yeah, so currently it's 12.4 acres or greater that we regulate. That threshold is staying the same until 2028, January 1st of 2028. Then the threshold drops down to 7.4 acres. So the thought process in their legislation when they were creating this law is that there will be enough work for us to do just to figure out the unusual importance criteria and regulating that. And there's going to be so much more regulation happening just with the unusual importance criteria and the maps being not regulatory anymore, that gives us a couple years to kind of work out the kinks and then be able to drop the threshold.
So if you're a resident, you're going to build a house, if you're building under 12.4 acres, you're going with the old rules or the original rules that are in the tech now, like the 100.
So if you're building, I'm sorry, I'm trying to hear you. If you're building a house on,
if you're a resident building a house and you're under 12.4 acres, is it just, what rules are you basing on? The 100-foot buffer, the rules that exist now?
Well, now, but because now there's going to be the unusual importance criteria. So there's no size limit to those. And so that's, if you believe that you are, your project is anywhere near a wetland, it is you need to get a jurisdictional determination first to see, okay, where is this wetland and what classification of a wetland is it? Because if it doesn't have any of those 11 criteria, then, and it's under 12.4, then you can go by that. You can build your part, you can do your project. But first you still have to get a JD, even if it is under 12.4, because of that unusual importance. There could be something there that deems it worthwhile to regulate. Does that answer your question?
Yes. No.
Hasn't the Corps of Engineers historically regulated wetlands less than 12.4 acres?
Yes.
Why is it necessary for New York State DEC to start to do that?
Because they do it on different, their classification scheme and what they deem as it, they're only looking at dredging and filling mainly. They're not looking at other, their regulated activities are less than what the state is.
But so your regulations are more comprehensive, Victor, than what the Corps of Engineers regulations are?
Yes.
Any other questions? I've got some written questions that I'll go over, but I'm wondering if somebody didn't get a chance to write them, if they want to ask a question.
You want to use the mic there?
She's not hearing you without this.
Who had the question? Awesome. Well, you'll start with Austin. I'll come over there.
Thanks.
My name is Austin Wheelock. I'm the Executive Director of Operations Oswego County. We're an economic development in all of Oswego County, as well as the CEO of the Oswego County IDA. We're currently involved in multiple property development projects, working with New York State Empire State Development to produce shovel-ready sites for major industrial projects. We're very concerned about this, especially if located within or adjacent to an urban area. That's never been looked at before. It's a completely new, and I know you're saying, hey, there's nothing we needed to do because it's already saying what it is, but it seems pretty arbitrary in terms of what is an urban area, what is not, or what is adjacent. Are there maps? I mean, there's a map here showing the urban areas, but there's nothing showing the adjacent urban areas. Do you have that? And could we see it? Because I just have concerns that we're going to be held under a completely new rules very soon, and I would argue that these are not urban areas; they're very rural areas.
Yeah, that is so. In the comments of the second round of the comment period, that has definitely been noted, and that is unfortunately we don't have the maps from Cornell yet. We don't have those SOPs yet. Like I said, we've been in the first step. And I know it's all kind of a lot and all at once. There is going to be a transition period, and there is it's going to be not smooth as we figure it out. But we recognize that, so it's not. It's just going to be a conversation, and you can start that conversation with your region, like you said. You're already actively working with the state on some things, and all of our regional managers, you know, they know what's going on and how large the uncertainty scale is at this. So we just have to keep that conversation open. We're not going to be jerks about it when it comes time to it. We understand it's a lot to ask.
Our engineers and our conversation today said try to get it done before January 1st. That's what they told us. Is their answer. So it's not really feasible to do that. Projects that take multiple years. This is just another question I had is that you mentioned early on that 1.2 million acres are currently regulated. You think that there's another million. So it's almost doubling the amount of regulated acreage. If and when that happens, does the state have any plan to reimburse local municipalities for loss of usable acreage when property owners successfully grieve their property assessments because land that they own is no longer usable and they are going to have their assessments?
Great question.
So, okay, I'm trying to reframe the question so I understand it. Is there some sort of compensation for landowners that they bought this property thinking there was no restrictions on it and now all of a sudden there's restrictions on it? Is that what you're saying?
That's one part of it, but more also for the communities that they have a certain tax base, you know, and the money they raise in terms of pay for, you know, the town bills and for a school district bill or whatever is tax rate times assessment equals the amount that they bring in. If, you know, the amount of wetland property is going to double or almost double, that means that they're going to then go to their towns and say, hey, the assessor currently says my home and my 10 acres is worth $250,000. I'm saying it's only worth $200,000 because this property in the back is no longer usable. And when they do that and the assessed values in town drop by 20 to 30%, maybe it's being hyperbolic, maybe it's not that much, but even if it's 5 to 10%, they need to make that money up somewhere. Does the state have any plan to help those communities, the authorities, to make up that difference?
Well, there is conservation easements. There are things, but that's municipality based. As far as a statewide, there is not anything yet, but it's in the comments and it is being considered.
There's a gentleman over there, Katie.
Yeah, on slide 43, you have limit disparities. I'm wondering if you can find that or admit that, so I can regulate how big you can make them. part of the wallet, so that we can't use up that whole area there.
I'm sorry, I have a really hard time hearing you. I heard on slide something, and that was about it.
This gentleman would like to see slide 43. Can you put that up?
Yep.
Krista?
Yes.
You might be able to hear you better up here.
Yeah, sorry, guys. So let me share 40.
She's getting slide 43.
Sorry, bear with me.
So, yeah, so you mentioned limit of disturbance in here, and I was looking for a definition as to what limit of disturbance is. So is that outside of actually building something? Is that like how big you can have your yards?
Yes, that's how big you can have your yard. So then.
So you're not just regulating buildings, you're regulating how big of yard space we can have as well.
Yeah, the limit. Yes, exactly. So you also have to think, what do people put in yards? They put in, depending on where they are, they put in septics, they might put in wells, they might put in pools.
And that's something the DEC wants to regulate?
If it's close to a, if it's close to a wetland and it's in the up against an adjacent area.
Almost feels like it's unconstitutional.
You don't see that as an overreach?
No, because you don't see that we need to protect these ecosystems. You don't see what's been going on because we've just been blatantly doing what we wanted for so long. These are protecting us from so many things.
I've seen frogs in my yard.
That's great. You're not going to see frogs very long if we keep doing what we're doing. The fact that it's 82 degrees tomorrow on Halloween.
Ma'am, it's 82 degrees 20 years ago, and I feel you should know your audience before you start going on this rant of yours.
I apologize for my reaction. I am had a very long day, and it is not your fault that I am exhausted.
Krista, I have four questions that four or five questions from the audience that were written down, and I'll two of them deal with the basically questions that are suggesting that DEC would be incapable of handling the additional workload associated with enumerating all of these additional wetlands, i.e. where you can't do it now, how are you going to do it with the additional increase in the reduction in the amount of wetland acreage?
Yep. And if that happens, then it's proof that we can't do it, and then we can petition to get more help.
So is that in the, are you doing that now? I mean, it's obvious.
There's
been challenges to you doing wetland delineation under the current law with the expanded stuff. Are you trying to get more staff?
Absolutely. Every single year we try to get more staff. We got 5 new hires with this legislation package. And we are fully aware that it's probably going to require more than just 5, but we're kind of like the child, and we have to ask the parent for such a thing.
And the most of the work with the new wetlands law is going to be done out of Albany. It's not going to be done regionally.
So it's a combination. The first initial is going to be Albany remotely, but Albany works with the region. The region will also be seeing what Albany is seeing remotely. And then if it's needed, they will go on site and give us on site feedback. We've been doing remote determination for large energy projects for years, so this isn't anything new to us. This is also a process that the Army Corps uses. They don't do regulatory maps, they do remote determinations. Most of the country has switched to remote determinations. It's just better technology, a better way to do it.
On your average energy project, what is the acreage on an average energy project?
Well, how big is Micron?
Well, what? I don't know. How big is it?
Thousands of acres?
thousands of acres, right?
So I don't know. I'm unfamiliar with how large, but I can come back to you with the answer of how big the energy projects are.
Well, I guess I'm trying to help what Rip he's stating that your statement was we track, you know, remote from Albany energy projects, but those are large projects, low, you know, not a large.
Yes.
And Rip's talking about, well, a lot of residential projects and many of them going on every day and permits going. And so you're going to be overwhelmed immediately. And so that's the concern.
I definitely understand the concern. We have the same concern here, which is why we petitioned for more staff. And right, that's right. What I'm saying. It is a catch 22, but something has to be done. This was also, we don't make the laws. The law was given to us to regulate. We are not the creators of the law. So we are doing the best that we can with what we have given. And that's where it's going to require a conversation and a trust, to trust that we all of us in the room just want to do the right thing. We know that there is a need for economic growth. There's a need. We're not trying to be the overreach, the government overreach. So start the conversation. We're not, just because you have wetlands on your property or adjacent area where you want to be, doesn't mean that you're not going to get a permit to build. It just requires a little bit more conversation with the state.
Well, you were, wouldn't it have been easier just to update the maps for the 7 million?
No. Now,
just to update them?
It took so many years just to update. It's too inefficient of a project and way, way too costly because we're losing more and more wetlands with the event. Like, it's just not worth it.
So I have two more questions.
Yeah.
Well, I have three more, actually. One, I'll read this one. Is the rationale for this new regulation a result of municipalities not doing a satisfactory job of protecting wetlands?
No, not at all. But this is a start.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I don't believe the charge for protecting wetlands is with the DEC.
Yeah.
The municipality primarily helps the landowner identify those wetlands.
Yeah.
But they're not charged with protecting.
No. There's an option in the statute where if there's a municipality that wants to take over the regulation of the wetlands, they can. And that's a whole other thing. There's only one or two places in the state where they have done that, and that they're both down in Long Island because they have very specialized tidal wetlands, different wetlands. But no, and that's what also, when I spoke to other municipalities early in this year, if you look at it this way, there's never been a wetlands outreach person for DEC. My position was created because of these regulations, and they saw, well, if you're going to totally change these regulations, you need to have somebody telling people about it. But there was never a person to really tell people about the old regulations. So municipalities have been very much in the dark for a long time. And it is my job to make sure that that is not the case going forward. It is my job to figure out how to best educate and give you guys the best tools so that you don't feel like we're pulling the rug out from underneath you. So you do feel like you can ask questions and, you know, be able to work with us and we're not working against you.
Okay, so if you're really serious about protecting vernal pools, which it appears that you are, because you've got a whole set of regulations that deal with that. Why would you make it voluntary, the identification of those pools voluntary?
Because that's part of the balance. If we came on down hard with all of these unusual importance criteria and dropping the threshold and getting rid of the regulatory maps, there's already upheaval with that. And then to put this to not be voluntary on top of that?
It really suggests an inconsistency, though. I mean,
it's not an inconsistency. It's our way of trying to be balanced, trying to do both good by the environment, but also good by the constituents and the economics of the state.
You probably won't get many people to volunteer their vernal pool.
Maybe not.
Just as a suggestion. Okay, the last written question I have. Go ahead, Neil. You got another question? No, the last written question I have is basically asking the relationship between Article 24, which is this wetlands law, and Article 15 as it relates to property owners that own property on, for example, Oneida Lake or a river that's currently regulated under Article 15. I can read this, but Tom, is that okay to ask her that? Or do you want me to be more specific?
Do I own my 200 feet between the lake and the road I live on, or is that going to be taken away from me? Do I own my home, or is it in some kind of a wet lane that the state is going to take over? Answer that.
This has to do with, I'll read Tom's question, but what this has to do with is with the ability of the state to designate a lake or a pond as a wetland. I know, I believe that they've had that ability, they've never done it. Now under this new law, they're going to, if the area of a lake or the lake itself meets certain criterion, they can designate that as a wetland.
Yeah.
That's accurate. Am I correct there?
Yes. So what the criterion is that makes that lake into a wetland, it's in a lake that has certain subaquatic vegetation that is, and it's usually, and it's always in shallow, weedy lakes.
So if you make, Oneida Lake fits that description, I can tell you that right now, and it has the plant species that, the indicator species that would classify it, could classify it that way. So if you designate a portion or all of Oneida Lake as a wetland, then that buffer zone is going to come into play, the 100-foot buffer zone from the lake back. Is that accurate?
And that is accurate. That's accurate. But also, let me tell you that we understand how this is a huge shift, and we do not want to regulate every single thing that was never regulated before in a lake. I couldn't come out to you today because I just got back from Chautauqua Lake, and we had a general permit meeting with them. So that was the general permit, because we were given these regulations. We have to regulate them. This is the law. So a general permit is our way of easing the burden of the regulations on the people who have lakefront property. And that would be something where it would be an activity-based general permit. And so frequently done activities like, so something that is regulated in a wetland would be dredging, filling, building a new structure. So when having this meeting, we were like, okay, what are the activities, the frequent activities that you do that you would want to put in a general permit? And things like fire pits came up. A lot of people want to build more fire pits. So, but something that is not a regulated activity in an Article 24 area on a lake would be regular maintenance. So if there's already an existing dock, if there's already a home that's within the adjacent area, if there's any maintenance, routine maintenance of that, there's no permit needed. There's nothing. It's when there's new builds and new dredging and new, like, even if there is a lake in Oneida Lake, if there is portions that have sand, right? Sandy beaches, if you've always had that sandy beach and you always have to replenish that sand every year, that's not regulated. That's routine maintenance. Now, if you wanted to create a new beach and put in sand somewhere else for the first time, that is a regulated activity if it's in the wetland, because that's considered adding fill. Does that answer your question?
Why wouldn't, you know, Article 15 basically regulates lakes and rivers as it relates to stream banks and river and bottoms. That wasn't satisfactory. I mean, that's not enough regulation. You needed this extra level of regulation to put onto the people to protect what?
Because in the law, it says that wetlands are different types of wetlands that we protect. And so one of those types of wetlands is subaquatic vegetation. So that is why we say, well, this is how we're going to handle that, because that is a lot, and we are going to handle it with general permits. It is the law that they gave us, and we are just trying to find the easiest way to implement that law without the most upheaval.
Who participated in drafting the changes in the law? Somebody had to put something, or I mean, is there somebody responsible for making these changes?
Yeah, the lawmakers.
Yeah, who? There's usually somebody puts their name to it. I mean, there's.
Yes, I can find that out for you if you send me an email and remind me of your name and send me it, like who your name.
These regulations came through the legislature. Is that what you're suggesting? And yes. There are bills that are introduced into the legislature.
Yes.
But the fact is that there isn't anybody in that legislature that's competent to identify any of the criterion that you've established in here. That had to come from DEC programs people.
Because then they start it, right? They start, okay, so we say, because we push to get the regulatory maps off. Right. That was in the regulatory package that we pushed forward because the maps are inefficient. But then sitting here and bickering about this doesn't do any good because it's happening. So I'm just trying to assist you with how it's happening.
I know it doesn't do any good, but at least we got to answer the questions, correct?
That's true. If it makes you feel better, I am happy to do that.
She's got, okay, we've got a question back there. Well, come on up and answer it.
My name is Brittany Jarrett. I'm with Assemblyman Barclay's office. And I'm just listening to the presentation and taking some notes tonight too. And I appreciate you circulating the letter and the statement that he put out with his concerns on this. But just to answer the question, I did a little research before coming here, and it was 2022's budget bill that this was a part of. So it was all within that massive part QQ, I think.
Yeah, it was.
And that was where it came from. So as far as we could track, it wasn't a particular author, but a program bill right from the governor.
To Rick's point, where like there's nobody there to draft that bill other than DEC input to push the bill through to. You know what I mean? I can't imagine them thinking this up on their own.
It's also why New York State needs to stop making laws through the budget process.
We can't agree with you more. thank you.
So before I go there, I got time. Did your question get answered? He's the only one of four that wrote it. I can read it verbatim. You want me to read it?
No. They're not taking your help.
Yeah. Okay, so we can take a few more questions. Go ahead. No, don't give him hell now. All she's got to do is hang up.
I won't do that no matter how mad I get. Don't worry.
So a quick just overview of what just happened to us is we bought 100 acres, and we bought it because originally on the maps, it was about 15 to 20 acres of wetlands. We were planning to have two new construction builds on it. And on one side of it where my father was building, he wanted to have the DEC come out and just map out the wetlands that were there to make sure we weren't in that original 100-foot buffer zone. Now, she came and made our entire piece of land wetlands. It's now 90 acres of wetlands instead of just the original 20, which is the reason why we bought it. So now moving forward, we have this small little corner, about 10 acres in the back left corner, that we are allowed to build on. And at this point, it's like, what is your permitting process going to look like? It's probably going to take, 10 years to get through it because you're going to have so many different permits. And how stringent are your regulations going to be on this permitting process if we did want to take, section out an acre, 2 acres, 5 acres of wetlands to maybe build on? And because now we have all wetlands, basically.
Yeah. And I totally hear how frustrating that is. And that is also a reason why the maps need to be redone. There's a lot of uncertainty. Currently, if you look at the environmental resource mapper, there's a 500-foot check zone that it says, and we give that 500-foot check zone because that's to say, hey, if you're anywhere, we give you 500 feet because there's an uncertainty here. And that sucks.
Okay, basically. 500 feet is a little bit different than changing in about 80 acres.
Yeah, and that's, so you're region 7?
Yes. Sure, yes.
Yes, yes, okay. And so the permitting process, there, like I said, especially after what you're dealing with, it's not that if you give a site plan, if you say what you want to do, we will work with you. There is building within an adjacent area. The first thing is to avoid. But if you can't avoid, and it sounds like you can't avoid, because now you're working, you went from 100 acres to 10 acres. And then, because you can't avoid, you're in to mitigate. Okay, well, what exactly is it that you want to do? And then they look at what you want to do and how big of an impact that would be onto the wetland, depending on what you want to do. So just, it's a back and forth.
How stringent are these going to be?
It's site specific. So did they tell you what classification those wetlands are?
No, not yet.
Okay, so that is a major thing. It's a lot different if it's a class 1 than a class 4.
Okay, now it's
I'm looking at so far. When did you start your process right now?
Well, I have built it. So we bought it, 2 years ago? 2 years ago.
The delineation just happened in the beginning of September. And I had already divided the property from 100 acres from 5 acres and 95. I gave her 5 acres of it.
Yep.
And when they did the delineation, they literally went on the driveway, which runs up the property line. The delineation runs right along the driveway, across where she wanted to build her house, across within 50 foot of the existing old barn that was there, and then heads to probably a northwest direction. And they literally cut right across there. I thought I was at this 2,200 foot of road frontage, and all we had to work with is the original driveway. 2,200 foot of road frontage is now all flattened. There's no room for a driveway, nothing, except for the existing driveway.
And I have some natural, I own that whole lot right there, 25 acres. They showed up with Onyx maps on their phone, BBC. And that's how we were mapping in that area. So the delineation process was a complete joke.
But she was feet on the ground. She walked around the whole time.
They did, yeah. They walked out.
Can you hear any of that, or is it?
What they're using for sure.
I'm trying to get the gist. I get the gist. Well, it's,
all she did was talk about the GPS coordinates of where she put her flag.
I was getting at the time frame because you obviously you guys want to proceed.
Well, I would like to start building in spring. And how long is this process going to take? Am I going to take a year of permitting, of going back and forth and back and forth, and I'm getting pushed another year to build?
So I guess I was trying to set an example.
No, that is not the goal. That is not the goal on our side either, because it just takes longer and longer. It drags it out for both of us.
Well, correct. I'm just wondering, again, with you're going to be overwhelmed in the amount of wetlands that we're now currently have. You're going to have in a crazy amount of permits, I can only imagine.
We'll have to see when we get there. I don't have a crystal ball.
All right.
So I think that we're going to have to wrap up the questions. It's 9 o'clock. We usually try to end by now. Krista's email address, I hope, is either probably on that documentation, and
it's also in the PDF of the slides.
So you can email her a question, and hopefully she'll get back to you. And beyond that, it is what it is. So, Krista.
Yes.
You still there? Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Thank
you. I hope you feel better.
Thank you.
Stay away from Chautauqua Lake. I'll see you later.
Bye. Have a good day, guys. Thanks. You for listening to Hard Stuff to Hear. But honestly, we're not trying to be jerks. Thanks.
Wanted to mention that Krista's presentation will be available as a PDF on the NARCOG website, which is narcog.org. The PDF will be there, and I believe the last slide has her email address on it. We're also planning on posting the Zoom recording of tonight's meeting on the NARCOG website as soon as I can get that up there.